The first lecture in this series deals with the interaction of radiation with biological matter, and specifically tries to get over the concept that biological dose and physical dose are really quite different. Radiation therapy is used to treat approximately 50% of cancer patients in the USA with curative intent, and approximately half of these are cured. So it's a very effective cancer. It has a very long history as well. Initially, X-rays were introduced by Röntgen for imaging, but very rapidly they became used for the treatment of non-cancerous conditions and later for cancerous conditions. The progress here was very rapid, so in fact the first cure of cancer by X-rays was in 1899, just a few years after the discovery. And rapidly they became introduced as a standard cancer treatment. Although there was great enthusiasm for the use of X-rays as a cancer treatment, it became clear that side effects were relatively common. This is a picture of some very late effects in a patient who was irradiated by fluorine at the age of 5 for nevus pigmentosus proliferus. And you can see that there's a really damaging effect. But this is taken at 70 years old. So although cancer therapy was ongoing, there was also the use of X-rays for a whole variety of non-cancerous diseases. And that is still the case in many parts of the world, and particularly in Europe, although it's less common in the States, largely because of litigation. At the same time as cancer was being touted as a great cancer cure, there was also introduced the concept that not only did it cause damage to normal healthy tissues, but it was also carcinogenic. So Hermann Müller got the Nobel Prize for showing that X-rays could produce mutations, and this was a very important driving force within many of this kind of scientific procedures that were done over the subsequent two decades. Very rapidly following the discovery of X-rays, natural radioactivity sources were discovered, first by Becquerel, and later by Marie Curie and Pierre Curie. Marie Curie, of course, is the only woman to have received two Nobel Prizes. The natural radioactivity now is known to be associated with, or to be characterized by, giving off alpha particles, beta particles, or gamma rays. And these, again, were introduced very rapidly into the clinic to treat and cure cancer. So the first cure of cancer by radium plaque was back in 1922. When we think about how radiation is used in the clinic, we always have to think of how a therapeutic benefit is derived from its use. And there are two ways in which this can be achieved. One is by physical means, by doing dose distribution alterations as a result of treatment planning, minimizing the amount of normal tissue within the field. The other is by biological means. And by biological means, most of the time we're really talking about dose fractionation. It's important to realize that in the very early days, the radiation sources were very weak. And it was only during the 1950s, 1960s that that it became possible to deliver radiation to depth with some semblance of efficiency. This is an important consideration because nowadays, of course, there are major changes in the way radiation is delivered as a result of IMRT, IGRT, gamma knife, etc. And all of these actually present radiobiologists with individual specific challenges. To go back to fractionation, in fact, fractionation came into practice really very early on. One of the major people who really put forward the concept that fractionation was something that was superior to single dose delivery was Coutard back in 1919. One of the reasons why fractionation became popular was, in fact, the fact that the early X-ray machines took a very long time to deliver dose. And, of course, a lot of the dose that they gave was localized to the skin. One of the ways of getting around these limitations was to use dose fractionation. In spite of this, they also kind of grew with time a radiobiological rationale, which was much more cogent for the use of dose fractionation. It became really quite clear that as people tried to give higher single doses of radiation, then the normal tissue became compromised, and in particular the late radiation sequelae became much more pronounced. So it became really very clear that high single doses of radiation were in general not an effective or useful way of delivering radiation, and it had some serious side effects and consequences. So with time, the concept arose that the best way of delivering radiation was with two gray fractions approximately, delivered more or less homogeneously to a field over a six-week time period. It became also clear that varying this schedule impacted the outcome, and it was important to understand what the consequences were of varying this particular schedule. Radiobiological principles that were derived from preclinical data and from clinical altered fractionation protocols. As I've already said, in fact, modern treatment now with IMRT and other forms of dose delivery actually create situations which diverge significantly from those that we were used to under the conventional protocols. So much of the radiobiology research has really focused upon the effects of dose fractionation and understanding why this gives a therapeutic benefit. In order to understand these and what happens whenever we move to the new concepts, one really needs to understand the difference between physical and biological radiation dose. But first, let's talk a little bit about what radiation is. Obviously, there are two types of radiation, non-ionizing radiation and ionizing radiation. And ionizing radiation is defined as having a wavelength less than approximately 10 to the minus 6 centimeters. And this kind of sets it apart from UV, infrared, and many other forms of radiation. So non-ionizing radiation is radiation which has a kinetic energy which is sufficient to raise the thermal energy of an outer shell of an electron and excite it, whereas ionizing radiation has enough kinetic energy to detach at least one electron from an atom or a molecule, and this creates ions. So charged particles, such as electrons, protons, heavy ions, alpha and beta particles, are directly ionizing. They interact directly with atomic electrons and transfer a major part of their kinetic energy directly. In contrast, photons and neutrons are chargeless. This gives them the advantage that they are actually more penetrating, but they are indirectly ionizing. Their kinetic energy is transferred to an orbital electron, which produces a fast recoil or Compton electron, and it's this that goes on then to create damage. So there is two different types of radiation: ionizing radiation that is directly ionizing, and radiation that is indirectly ionizing. And the difference, really, as far as radiation therapy is concerned, is that the major component in radiation therapy is the Compton effect, whereby this photon interacts with a loosely bound free orbital electron and results in that being scattered. So ionizing radiation produces ions, ion radicals, free radicals, and these are highly reactive. It's these that cause damage to biological matter. It's important to realize the free radical half-time is in the order of 10 to the minus 6 seconds, so a loss of the chemistry takes place very, very rapidly after radiation exposure. Over the next period of hours, there's repair of much of that damage, and over hours to days to weeks, there are early biological effects, and then comes late biological effects, which are generally considered as taking place after the normal 6 weeks that we use in classical radiation therapy. The physical dose that is delivered is measured in gray, which causes about 2 times 10 to the 5 ionization events per cell, and about 2,000 occur within DNA. The fact that radiation can be directly or indirectly ionizing should be considered as very separate from what we talk about as the direct and indirect action of radiation. As I already said, indirectly ionizing radiation results in the release of photons, fast electrons, being generated. And these go on to either act directly or indirectly on biological targets. If, in fact, the ion pairs and free radicals are produced in a biological target such as DNA, then we talk about this as being the direct action of ionizing radiation. On the other hand, if water or other atoms or molecules are ionized, and this produces free radicals, and those free radicals then go on to produce damage, then we talk about this as being the indirect action. So here is a cartoon of the direct and indirect action of ionizing radiation. Obviously, for free radicals to be relevant in terms of damage, they have to be produced in a fairly close proximity to a biological target. So in this case, as far as DNA is concerned, they have to be produced within about 4 nanometers of DNA for them to be effective. Otherwise, because of their short half-life, they are ineffective. Because ionizing radiation brings about this indirect effect working through largely water, and this is the most common ionization event, is the radiolysis of water with the production of reactive oxygen species. And this water is, of course, as far as a biological target like DNA is concerned, it's the water which is most tightly bound within the DNA. Now, the reactive oxygen species which are generated are reducing and oxidizing in nature, but the net effect of the production of these free radicals and ion radicals is oxidation of the cellular constituents of the cell. We believe that about two-thirds of DNA damage caused by X-rays is due to the production of reactive oxygen species, and about 75% of the indirect action of radiation is due to hydroxyl radical production. How these free hydroxyl radicals actually work to cause damage is still not absolutely clear, but it certainly can be by more than one mechanism. For example, it could be by addition or hydrogen abstraction or by electron transfer to the organic moiety. The end result, however, is that you get free radicals being produced within biological material, and it's the interaction of these free radicals with each other and with other constituents that ends up with the damage which is caused. So all of this means that free radicals are very important in radiation therapy, and that this free radical biology feeds into many other forms of biology. For example, during cellular respiration, there are many, many free radicals produced. Free radicals are used in defense against bacteria and viruses. Because of this, and because of the large number of free radicals produced in the cell, we have endogenous defense mechanisms. For example, we have endogenous free radical scavengers. These endogenous free radical scavengers or antioxidant mechanisms can neutralize some of the effects of ionizing radiation. And by the same kind of process, if you deliver drugs which act as free radical scavengers, then these can protect normal tissues from radiation. On the other hand, decreasing the levels of endogenous free radical scavengers can result in more damage. One of the most important elements within this process is oxygen. It's been known for a long time that oxygen is extremely important in the biological effects of ionizing radiation. It can bind hydrogen radicals forming hydrogen peroxide, or it can bind to electrons to give superoxide. But probably the most relevant issue here is the fact that it can bind to these organic radicals and peroxides that we just talked about being produced in organic material, biological material. And it's these peroxides that are formed which are particularly dangerous as far as the cell is concerned. So the concept is that oxygen fixes the radical lesions in DNA, and it does this in a form that makes them unable to be chemically repaired. This means that oxygen is a very powerful radiation sensitizer. You can look at the power of oxygen as a radiation sensitizer using the oxygen enhancement ratio, which is the dose required to produce a specific biological effect in the absence of oxygen over the dose required for the same effect in its presence. In other words, this is an iso-effect formula. The oxygen enhancement ratio varies with the level of effect, but it can certainly be in the order of 2.5 to 3.4, which is a huge effect. This can be measured in vitro just by taking a simple suspension of cells, irradiating them under oxic and hypoxic conditions, plating them out, and the surviving cells will be able to grow into the form to form colonies. These colonies can be counted about 10-14 days later, and the surviving fraction plotted against dose on a log linear relationship. And you can see here just how potent oxygen is in terms of its radiosensitizing effect. So it's very clear here that physical dose and biological dose are not the same thing. It depends upon the level of oxygen which is present. The clinical relevance of this is very high. The first kind of demonstration that hypoxia could alter a clinical response was by Schwartz, who showed that if you strapped the radiation source onto an arm, it was much less effective in causing a skin reaction than radium which was just placed on the arm. And he attributed this to the fact that there was hypoxia induced. Nowadays, we can look at the level of hypoxia a variety of different ways, which we'll talk about later. But one is using pimonidazole, which is an oxygen mimetic compound, which can then be stained for. And if you look at cancers using something like pimonidazole, you can see that they contain really significant areas of hypoxia. Normal tissues generally don't produce the same kind of levels of hypoxia. And this can be attributed to the tortuous kind of vasculature within tumours. So hypoxic areas occur almost solely in tumours and are more radio-resistant than oxygen areas. And this contributes to treatment failure. One of the rationales for dose fractionation is that reoxygenation may occur between dose fractions. And this could be very important in terms of the outcome of radiation therapy. At the same time, we know the oxygen effect is greater, of course, for low LET than high LET radiation, which is what one might expect, knowing the way that these different forms of radiation cause damage. It's worth thinking about just how important the quality of radiation is in terms of biological effectiveness. the linear energy transfer, high LET or low LET radiation, is assessed quantitatively by the average energy imparted by excitation and ionization events caused by a charged particle traveling a set distance. So this is the official definition of LET. It's the number of ionization events per unit path length, KeV per micrometer. If you look at gamma rays, they are sparsely ionizing radiation. Soft X-rays are more ionizing. Alpha particles are highly ionizing in terms of LET. So as you move from low LET to high LET radiation, you can see there's a big difference in the way energy is deposited within a cell, and of course in the biological consequences as well. So we know, therefore, that a dose of 1 gray will give a couple of thousand ionization events in a cell nucleus, but you can actually achieve that in many different ways. 1 MeV electrons will give about, say, 700 electrons or 6 ionization events per micrometer, whereas 4 MeV protons will give the same number of total ionization events, but they're being delivered as 14 protons giving 300 ionizing events per micrometer. So although these are all the same number of ionization events given by 1 gray, the biological effects of these different forms of radiations is really significantly different. LET itself is actually a very poor measure of biological consequences. It's a physical measure. It's an average measure of ionization events deposited per unit path length. The relative biological effectiveness on the radiation is a much better way of looking at the quality of radiation. And the relative biological effectiveness, or RBE, is the dose of 250 kVp X-rays required to produce an effect, divided by the dose of test radiation required for the same effect. And again, you can see that high LET radiation is biologically much more effective than low LET radiation. And this is by a factor, again, of 2.5 to 3 fold. So physical dose and biological dose are really very different. If you look at the size of RBE as a function of LET, you can see that for cobalt 60 or for gamma rays, diagnostic X-rays, you really have not a great difference from 250 kVp X-rays in terms of its biological effectiveness. However, whenever you get up to 50, to 100, to 150 kEV per micrometer, there is a big increase in terms of the relative biological effectiveness of the radiation. And whenever you get above 150, you get into an overkill kind of situation where the dose is essentially being wasted. The interpretation of this curve is that whenever you get to about 100 to 150 kV per micrometer, the average distance between ionization events is about the same as the distance between DNA strands. In other words, you're much more likely to cause a double strand break in this region. And that's one of the reasons why things like alpha particles are so cytotoxic in comparison with gamma rays. It's important to realize, of course, that the oxygen enhancement ratio will decrease in an inverse manner with RBE. So the oxygen enhancement ratio falls off whenever you get to 100 kV per micrometer. And this, of course, is because it depends considerably on the indirect action of ionizing radiation. In radiation therapy, we tend to talk about DNA as being the primary target for radiation within a cell. And the reasons for this is that if you irradiate just the cell cytoplasm, you tend not to cause cell death, whereas if you irradiate the nucleus, then you do. Tritiated thymidine, if it's incorporated into cells in high amounts, can kill cells, and that, again, is going into the DNA. Radiation-induced chromosomal abnormalities correlate very well with cell death and carcinogenesis. And so all of this goes together to suggest that both for radiation killing and for carcinogenesis, the DNA is the primary target within the cell. However, radiation of the cytoplasm is not without biological consequences. And again, this is something that we'll come back to later. The lesions that are caused by ionizing radiation within DNA are actually really quite large. They're about 15 to 20 nucleotides in size. This is really quite important because it tends to put radiation apart from many of the chemotherapy agents. Or, for example, for free radicals caused by exposure of cells to hydrogen peroxide or other mechanisms. What is happening here is that the energy is deposited in packets within the DNA, and this is why these lesions are large. So whenever you look at the type of damage which is caused to DNA by radiation exposure, there's about 1,000 single-strand breaks per cell per gray, 30 to 40 double-strand breaks per cell per gray. There's a lot of base changes, base loss, base modification. There's a smaller number of intra-strand and inter-strand cross-linking goes on, DNA protein cross-linking, and sugar damage. Now, obviously, this damage is really quite considerable, but the ratio of double-strand breaks to other forms of damage following ionizing radiation exposure tends to be really quite high. It's also true that not all of these ionization events are going to be lethal. Whenever you irradiate a tumor, then as a rough guide, approximately half the cells survive after 2 gray. And so as you get another 2 gray, another half will be killed, another 2 gray, another half, and this is really how radiation works. So you can work out that if the surviving fraction after 2 gray is 0.5, after 60 gray it will be 0.5 to the power of 30, or 0.9 times 10 to the minus 9. And since a 1 centimeter tumor contains approximately 10 to the 9 cells, one has some hope of actually curing that tumor if the surviving fraction is about 0.5. On the other hand, of course, if the surviving fraction is 0.7, then you really have no hope of curing the tumor with 60 gray. So this leads to the question of what is the lethal lesion within DNA following exposure to ionizing radiation. Obviously, most of the damage that is caused is repairable, and we talk about this as being repairable sublethal damage. And the lethal lesion is thought to be large, multiply damaged sites which are incapable of being repaired. These are double-strand breaks, but not just a normal double-strand break, but a double-strand break which is of a considerable size. We talk about this as being single lethal hits, sometimes known as alpha-type killing. Now, it follows that whenever you actually increase the dose, or you kind of increase the dose rate, then you might end up with interaction between tracks of ionizing radiation within the cell. So the repairable sublethal damage may accumulate to form unrepairable lethal multiple damage sites. We often talk about this as being beta-type killing, this accumulated damage. It also follows from these considerations that if you look at the difference between high dose rate radiation and low dose rate radiation, as you decrease dose, then you're going to move away from this accumulated lethal damage and allow repair to go on continuously. So the slope of a low dose rate survival curve and a high dose rate survival curve are really very different. And again, this means that physical dose and biological dose are not the same. There are many other considerations whenever you think of how ionizing radiation affects DNA. For example, the chromatin structure of the DNA is important. The basic unit of DNA is the nucleosome, and this gets wrapped around by histones and become compacted to form compacted chromatin. Chromatin compacts and decompacts during the cell cycle. It's maximally compacted during mitosis, whereas it has to decompact to facilitate proliferation and transcription as well. Compact chromatin is more radiosensitive than non-compacted chromatin, so mitotic cells are more radiosensitive than non-mitotic cells. And by the same token, actively transcribing genes are less sensitive to damage than those which are not being transcribed. This process of compaction and decompaction requires acetylation and deacetylation of histones by enzymes like acetyltransferases and deacetylases. And the histone deacetylase inhibitors are actually entering the clinic now as anti-cancer agents. And some of these have been shown to radiosensitize tumors. The important issue here really is that the radiation damage to DNA is not really randomly distributed, and it varies with the cell cycle phase and gene expression. So cells that are in G2M are much more radiation sensitivity than those in G1, then early S, and those in late S are very radiation resistant. And again, we're talking about 2.5-fold differences, which varies depending upon the level of effect. But obviously, the response of a cell in late S is very different than the response of a cell in G2M. So physical dose and biological dose are not the same. The importance of some of these factors, these biological factors, in terms of the radiation response, in particular to fractionated radiation, was really brought to the fore by a paper by Withers and Alkind. They use a macrocolony assay of the mouse jejunum to assess the effects of two radiation doses given varying times apart. And what they showed was that if you separate the two doses by 2 hours, then there was an increase in survival, or recovery factor, as they put it. And this was even more marked after 4 hours or 6 hours, with the recovery factor being the order of 30-fold. Whenever the two doses were separated by 12 hours, however, there was a decrease in survival, and this was considered to be due to redistribution of cells, so that during the first, after the first dose, most of the cells in G2M were killed. With time, the resistant cells would move through to the G2M phase, and if the time between the doses was correct, then this would give an increased radiation sensitivity. So this was called redistribution. Of course, if the interval went longer than about 18 or 24 hours, then you got an increase in survival again due to repopulation of cells. So this is 3 of the 4 hours of fractionated radiation therapy as they relate to radiobiology. Repair, redistribution, and repopulation are radiobiological phenomena which will impact the outcome of radiation therapy. should be noticed that whenever you look at these pieces of gut following radiation, after 12.5 gray, there's very little seeming effect of radiation. After 14 gray, there are lots of colonies developing with time after radiation. After a single dose of 15.5 gray, you can see very marked colonies. All of these are coming now from single surviving cells within the base of the gut. After 17 gray, almost all of these are totally ablated. So you can see here that this dose response curve is very, very steep for what is this particular complication of radiation. The other important aspect which Withers in particular and Howard Thames and others worked on was the fact that different tissues have different types of radiation sensitivity. So late responding tissues, the survival curve tends to bend considerably, whereas for acute responding tissues and many tumors, it's much more linear. This is, of course, extremely important type of finding. Acute responding tissues tend to turn over more rapidly. Late responding tissues will turn over more slowly. But the intrinsic radiation sensitivity of the tissues seems to be really quite different. So again, physical dose and biological dose are different. It varies with the tissue type. The importance of this, of course, for the clinic is that whenever you fractionate your radiation doses, that if you go down to low doses of radiation and you fractionate out, late responding tissues are very greatly spared by this process. On the other hand, the acute responding tissues are spared much less. So dose fractionation spares late responding tissues more than acute responding tissues and many tumors. This is the major kind of biological basis for fractionation. Always within radiation therapy and all forms of other therapy for that matter, the aim is to increase the therapeutic benefit. And this slide here sums up really the whole art of radiation therapy. What you see is that these steep dose response curves for normal tissue damage or for tumor control. In order to get a therapeutic benefit, the probability of tumor control must increase before the probability of normal tissue damage. And the aim of radiation therapy is to increase the window between these two curves and get maximal effect. So in summary, the biological effectiveness of radiation therapy varies. It varies with the size of the dose, it varies with the size of the dose per fraction, the time over which it's delivered, the time between fractions, the volume irradiated, the quality of irradiated, the presence or absence of oxygen, DNA repair, the cell cycle phase and level of gene activation, and the tissue or tumor type. And all of these factors really have to be taken into account whenever you give radiation to a tissue. So physical dose and biological dose are really very different. The most important way of thinking of this is through thinking of how the four R's of radiobiology relevant to clinical dose fractionation work. Repair of sublethal damage will spare late responding normal tissue preferentially. Redistribution or reassortment of cells in the cell cycle will have an effect more upon acute effect tissues than late effect tissues, and will also increase the extent of damage to tumor because the tumor is thought to be cycling relatively fast. Repopulation or regeneration will spare acute responding normal tissue preferentially. It will have no influence on late effect tissues. But there'll be a danger of tumor repopulation as a result. Reoxygenation is thought to have no influence on normal tissue responses, but was very likely to affect tumor damage as you get reoxygenation between fractions.